This is Edward October, host of October Pod on YouTube. Hear that jingle jingle? It could be Kris Kringle, or a home invader looking for an open window, a jilted lover looking for revenge, or a disgruntled co-worker hoping to spike your eggnog with arsenic. The girls of our true crime podcast are always on Santa's nice list, but the crimes they discuss are very naughty indeed. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, Cam, how are you?
Merry Festivus, Miss Kris.
Day six. Stuff. We are on day six.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Halfway there, living on a prayer. Yes. Trust me, that's what it's like trying to get all these written out. I'm just living on a prayer right now. Praying and hoping. Getting it all done.
Praying, hoping, and wishing.
I hope everybody's having a great holiday season. Getting everything done, or at least trying to at least have lists made that you need to get.
I'm just looking forward to the food.
Yeah,
food
is always good. It is. Yummy, yummy for my tummy.
Yeah. And snow. I hope it snows. Gosh, I hope it snows. I love snow.
Could be. We're supposed to have the coldest winter this year.
And that's why it's almost 80 today on October 24th in Missouri. Way to go. I thought that
Is Missouri.
That was false information. And I was like, that cannot be right. I looked it up. Yeah,
was it yesterday, the day before it got down to 40-something degrees?
Mm-hmm. See your breath.
Exactly.
See your breath and go swimming in the same week. Welcome to Missouri.
Well, we're going to get in the Christmas spirit now because I've got day six for us.
Let's
you
go.
Ready?
I am ready.
Day six.
Ready.
I'm going to tell you about a petty thief who, for a 14-month period in 1989 to 1990, started murdering defenseless elderly women in Mossman, which is a suburb of Sydney, Australia. It's just less than an hour north of Wanda Beach from where we discussed on day two. Remember the murders on Wanda Beach?
I do.
So today we're talking about the Granny Killer.
Ew, I don't like him.
I know, already. 82-year-old widow Gwendolyn Mitchell Hill was found right outside her apartment building at around 4 p.m. on March 1st, 1989. Two children had just stepped off the elevator when through the glass security doors, they saw this poor, older woman crawling on her hands and knees. She had an immense amount of blood coming from her head. The woman's belongings, her shoes and cane, lay neatly just a few feet away, and her pantyhose were off, and the purse was open. Now, this is a retirement community, and the children were visiting their grandparents. They assumed that she had fallen and hit her head, so an ambulance was called, and she was rushed to the hospital. But one keen-eyed ambulance driver noticed the open purse and then asked, you know, everybody check for her wallet. The wallet wasn't inside, so they reported it to the police. When she was taken to the hospital, some kind neighbors took it upon themselves to gather up Mrs. McMitchell's cane and purse, as well as clean up all the blood from the sidewalk.
Ugh.
At the hospital, the doctors were kind of suspicious of Mrs. Mitchell Hill's wounds. The wound was to the back of her head, and if she had tripped, she probably would have hit the front of her head. She also had two black eyes and some broken ribs. Miss Mitchell Hill had to be rushed to the emergency surgery, and unfortunately, at 8:45 p.m., she passed away.
Oh, no.
The hospital reported their suspicions to the police department, and an investigation into her death was opened. When detectives go to the crime scene, they were saddened to find that everything had been scrubbed away. But they were able to determine that her wallet was gone. The postmortem showed that Miss Mitchell Hill had received three blows to her head with a heavy, blunt object, and she also had a massive injury to her chest. Police made inquiries into her whereabouts that day, They recreated her steps, but there was no leads. No one had seen anything of what happened. Nothing at all. And even though this happened very close to a very busy street. So police just assumed that it was a mugging that went terribly wrong. 2 months later, 84-year-old widow Lady Winifreda Ashton, she was the wife of a very famous impressionist artist, Sir John William Ashton, very famous in Australia. She was found laying in a pool of her blood in a trash room of her apartment building. A neighbor found her, and at first she just thought Lady Ashton had suffered a heart attack. It was only after they saw that her shoes and cane had been neatly placed at her feet that they realized something was not right. Police arrived, and at first glance, they think Lady Ashton had been sexually assaulted since her pantyhose had been removed. But upon closer look, they see that the pantyhose had been wrapped tightly around her neck. They were able to determine that she had been laying there for 4 hours before she had been found. They recreated Lady Ashton's steps, and they found out that she had just come home from a luncheon. She'd grabbed her mail and then went to the trash room to throw away the junk mail. And that's when the attacker had snuck up behind her in a blitz attack. Lady Ashton did put up a struggle, but unfortunately she wasn't strong enough to fight off her attacker. The attacker did steal her wallet and a gold watch before leaving the building. Postmortem revealed that she had several blows to the back of her head, most likely from the concrete floor, like he banged her head on the concrete floor. Her nose and several ribs had been broken. Police begin to believe that the person responsible for Lady Ashton's death was the same one that killed Mrs. Mitchell Hill. They were in a mile of each other. The attacks happened around the same time in the late afternoon. Shoes and cane were placed neatly next to the bodies. They were robbed, and of course the obvious, they were about the same age. And these are all happening around retirement communities, like apartment buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And Mossman, I believe, is a pretty posh area, and a lot of elderly live around there.
And it's sad because they are defenseless, really. They you know, really they're a lot are. Older and it's
fragile, easy very victim. Fragile
yes.
women.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. One of Lady Ashton's neighbor claimed to have seen a young man around the apartments earlier the day of her attack. She described him as a young, surfy or druggy type with blonde or fair hair. A sketch of the man was put out to the media, and police received over 500 phone calls, but no real leads were found. On July 15th, a woman calls the police and said she'd been cleaning out Lady Ashton's mailbox and discovered her red wallet was inside. Everything was inside the wallet except all the money. If there was money, it was gone. There were no fingerprints at all.
He returned it?
Well, the police put a call out and said, if anybody knows anything about this, you know, let us know. The person who did find the wallet actually said that they didn't know that she had been attacked and killed. She had just found it, ironically enough, or oddly enough, in the park that was named after Lady Ashton's husband, Ashton Park.
I wonder if that was on purpose.
I don't know. So, of course, the elderly women in the area are a bit frightened, and rightfully so. And I'm sure it didn't help that the detective sergeant from the homicide squad told the Sydney Herald that there was a, quote, madman out there.
Yikes.
Caused a little bit panic. So around this time, the towns around Mossman, different police stations around the area, were getting reports of a gray-haired pie salesman that had been groping women at retirement centers. A gray-haired man punched a woman as she was walking into her apartment. He had hit her in the chest and ran off with her purse and groceries. And since all this was happening in different areas, nobody put all these together. They were just separate incidences. About 4 p.m. on October 18th, 1989, two men were walking past the Garrison Retirement Village when they heard 86-year-old Doris Cox crying for help. They found her sitting under the stairs with blood gushing from her head and her purse open next to her. The men assumed that she had fallen and she was immediately taken to the hospital. And once again, the nice neighbors were there to scrub the area down. Mrs. Cox was treated for head injuries, but the doctors feel that the injuries were a bit too severe for a simple fall. So the police were called. Police were all excited that, you know, they have maybe a witness to these muggings. Mm-hmm. When they got there, they were sad to learn that Ms. Cox had no memory of the attack.
Oh.
She had no memory whatsoever. She had Alzheimer's.
Oh.
So she didn't even know why she was in the hospital. And I saw pictures of this poor woman's face.
Oh,
trust me.
Thing.
The person doing this went to hell. She was bruised and bloodied and swollen, and there's no excuse. Mm-hmm. No excuse for this to happen. Just a month later, on November 22nd, less than 5 miles away in a town called Lane Cove, a 9-year-old girl was walking home from school when she came across an elderly lady lying bloodied on the sidewalk. 85-year-old widow Margaret Pod had several injuries to her head and was barely breathing. Her shoes and cane lay close by, and her legs were bare. She didn't have on any pantyhose. And people have to remember, in 1989, early 90s, pantyhose were the thing. You had to wear pantyhose. You wore a dress, you wore pantyhose. It wasn't until late 90s, I think, that people stopped wearing pantyhose, right?
I don't know. I
can't even remember. But yeah. I just know that the older women, like women that were fancy in the 1950s, I mean, my mom still wears pantyhose all the time. I mean,
so
that was just, you know, pantyhose. You wore pantyhose. You did not wear a dress or anything without pantyhose. So having a woman lie there without pantyhose, especially in the 80s, was a big deal. An ambulance was called out, but Mrs. Pod unfortunately passed before the ambulance arrived. Once again, a postmortem would show that Mrs. Pod had been hit in the head. Two blows that had been done with such force, it shattered her skull. And it was so bad that forensics couldn't even identify the weapon that was used. And of course, by the time the police get to the area, nice neighbors doing their duty scrubbed down the area.
See,
they
I'm
washed away any
police didn't come and say, hey, you know what?
Well, they thought she had fallen. It's an older woman. She probably tripped and fell and hit her head. That's what everybody's thinking.
Yeah.
And so they trying to be nice and wash away the blood is not to hurt or to scare anyone or anything. So they washed the area down.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, all the evidence, there's not been any evidence. The only thing that was not washed away was Ms. Ashton's thing, Lady Ashton. Nobody had seen anything on that particular day that was out of the ordinary. Mm-hmm. Although one of Mrs. Pod's neighbors, when she did was talk, she did mention that she had this nice gray-haired man had helped her carry groceries, but when she asked him in for tea, he declined.
Oh.
But they talked and he was just the nicest man. And police, now they're flustered. They have nothing. There's no fingerprints. There's no weapons. There's nothing. All they know is the attacks were most likely done by the same person. And all these attacks were happening around 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Why wasn't anyone seeing these attacks?
Mm-hmm.
They were happening out in the open. I mean, there was no really hiding. They were just flustered. They had no idea what was going on. Plus, all their crime scenes have been washed away. Could not imagine going up to like the third one. And once again, it's just gone.
Be like, what? Where am I living? Yes.
So with 3 elderly women dead and 1 attempted murder on an elderly woman, the media jumped on the fact that there was a serial killer around the North Shore area, and they gave him the moniker, the Granny Killer.
Oof.
Now, police barely had time to dig into the investigation of Mrs. Pod's death when they received another call about another elderly victim. 81-year-old Olive Cleveland had been found on the sidewalk by the Wesley Garden Retirement Village where she had lived. The staff had moved her body into the building's morgue and cleaned up the scene. Because, once again, they thought she'd fallen.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't think this incident would have been an attack, much less a victim of the Granny Killer. And they also didn't want to cause distress to the other residences, or the other people that lived in the residence. But once they thought about how odd she looked as they saw her lying there, they called the police. It seems that Ms. Cleveland's dress had been pulled up, her stockings removed, and her glasses and her shoes laid next to her body.
Mm-hmm.
It was also discovered that her stockings had been tied tightly around her neck, and they were so tight that they became embedded in the skin. Police go through her things and see that her wallet had been taken. And then someone comes forward saying that they saw a man in his late 20s, possibly, in dark clothes leaving the area, and he was carrying a long piece of wood. So by now, police are really needing to catch this man. There's a lot of stress put on the police force. It's number one priority. So a task force of 70 people was swiftly put together, and they had some of the most experienced investigators of the area. Police officers were put on foot patrol in neighborhoods where there was a high concentration of senior citizens. Officers held seminars teaching elderly about personal security. Dry cleaners were asked to notify police if any blood-stained clothing is brought in. There's a 24-hour hotline set up and a $200,000 reward, or as today's would be $443,000, almost half $1 million.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Was offered for any information leading to the arrest of this person. I mean, the police did everything they could think of. I mean, they even went undercover as gardeners in retirement villages just in hopes of finding this bastard.
I was hoping you would say they went undercover as old ladies.
Oh, no, that would be very...
And then that guy would have got the shock of his life.
Uh-huh. Mrs. Pod's purse would soon be found near a golf course and turned into police, but unfortunately, forensics would find no prints or money in the bag. A person in the area would tell police that they recalled seeing a mid-20-year-old surfy-type person with shoulder-length light brown hair in the area the day Mrs. Pod was found on the sidewalk. On the morning of November 24th, a concerned neighbor noticed that her elderly 93-year-old widowed neighbor had not gotten the food that Meals on Wheels had left for her the night before. Using the key that she was given, the neighbor finds 93-year-old widow Muriel Falconer dead with a pool of blood under her head. She was lying face down and her skirt had been pushed up over her hips, exposing her from the waist down. Her pantyhose tied so tightly around her neck that they cut into the skin, and her shoes had been placed neatly by her body. Since the crime scene hadn't been cleaned like they many times before, they were finally able to get a few clues. On the carpet were bloody footprints that led to the back of the house. The print was photographed, and a print of the shoe was photographed, and then they ran it to try to find. You know how they caught the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, how they were able to find the prints of the shoes matched up?
Right.
They did the same thing with this. But with this shoe print, they couldn't find anything on no print matched up. But they were able to say that it was, the shoe looked like something an older person would wear. So it wasn't a tennis shoe. It was kind of like a hard shoe, like a dress shoe type
loafer
shoe. Postmortem showed that Ms. Falconer was killed the previous day by blows to the head, what appeared to be made by a hammer.
Yeah.
Police canvassed the area, and they spoke with everybody in the neighborhood. One boy recalled seeing an old gray-haired man on the day of the murder. Another neighbor saw a rough-looking young man. And that's it. No other leads. But a few weeks later, the police would get a phone call from the neighbor, saying that she did remember seeing a well-dressed, gray-haired man in his 60s crossing the road in front of Mrs. Falconer's house. So police start to rethink that maybe they're looking for the wrong kind of person. Maybe it's not a 20-year-old. Maybe they need to look into older, gray-haired men that may be kind of portly, a little chunky. They run it, and sure enough, a bunch of incidents popped up, two of which, what I mentioned earlier, about the pie salesman and the other woman. Well, one was a robbery, an assault of an 80-year-old woman by the name of Euphema Carney, or Effie, which I've always loved the name Effie, by the
way. I like Euphema, too. That's so cute.
Euphema, or Effie, was walking home with her groceries when a gray-haired man, on the chubby side, quickly approached her. She slowed down because she thought he was going to ask her a question. Instead, he punched her in the chest, which sent her falling to the ground. The man stole her purse and groceries and then ran away. Another incident involved an 84-year-old widow by the name of Margaret Todhunter. Now, this happened way back in January, even before Ms. Mitchell Hill was killed. Ms. Todhunter was visiting a friend, and she went for a walk. And on the walk, a heavy, gray-haired man came up behind her and hit her over the head. He then took her purse and left her bleeding from a head wound. When police go back and speak with Ms. Todhunter, she's able to tell a sketch artist what this portly gray-haired man looked like. So the task force changed up on who they're looking for, but they don't make the new information public. They kind of keep it. They hold it back.
That's good.
Maybe. On January 11th, 1990, police are called to the Greenwich Hospital. A gray-haired man had entered the room of an elderly cancer patient by the name of Daisy Roberts. Now, pretending to be a doctor, this man put his hand in Mrs. Roberts' nightgown and fondled her.
What?
Upon investigating, police found out that the man who did this was a salesman from 4-20 Pie Company. His name was John Glover, and he had been visiting the catering officer that day. Like, he would go into retirement communities that serve lunches and stuff, and he would sell the pies for his company to be served at the lunches. Constable Pam Whitaker calls Glover at his home in Mossman. Where's that? That's where all the attacks have been. And he agrees to speak with her because she wants to get down to why this happened, see what his side of the story is. And he says, yes, I'll come talk to you tomorrow. All about this alleged sexual assault at the hospital. I'll come talk. But you know what? He never shows up.
Yeah. Color me shocked right there.
When she calls the house to see where he is, his wife goes, hold on, and puts a doctor on the phone. Seems like Glover was just rushed to the hospital because he had attempted suicide. Glover had taken lots of Valium pills and whiskey, and fortunately he would survive. He did leave a suicide note with the words, no more grannies on it. Now, Glover said that it was because both of their mothers had recently died that he wrote this, and that's why he was suicidal.
Wrong.
And since the task force didn't tell anybody they were no looking for a young man, they were looking for an older man for the granny killer, Constable Whitaker didn't put it together. But a week later, Constable Whitaker was able to speak with Glover and get a photo of him. And when Mrs. Roberts was shown the photo, she immediately recognized him and said, yep, that's that man.
Ugh.
So the following month, the task force gets their hands on the suicide note and the photo. The photo is a dead ringer for the sketch that Mrs. Todhunter had given. They gave the photo to Mrs. Todhunter and to Miss Carney, and sure enough, they ID'd him. They're like, yep, that's the guy. That's our guy. So now the task force know that John Wayne Glover is the granny killer.
And he was married with the family.
With two kids, two teenage daughters. Police dig into Glover's past. And they found that he had migrated from England in 1957. And he had a file at Scotland Yard for petty thefts. They also found that he committed assaults on two women in 1962. One an older woman, one a younger woman. He was let go on a good behavior bond and told to seek help. Now, what's a good behavior bond, you ask?
What's a good behavior bond, Jen?
Thanks for asking, Camille. I've got it right here for you. Under a good behavior bond, a person who has been found guilty of an offense promises to be of good behavior for a set period of time, up to 3 years.
Wait,
so basically probation.
So they're asking a thief who's doing bad things to people, we're going to let you go. But you got to promise to be good.
Right. It's pretty much a parole. Time served, I guess, with good behavior. I don't know. But they let him go. Police then go talk to Glover's psychiatrist. And, you know, usually doctor-patient confidentiality. The doctor went ahead and broke the confidentiality. I guess there's certain specifics in which they can when police are involved. But Glover was a 57-year-old married father at the time, father of two teenage girls, and he worked as a sales rep as the pie salesman. He was impotent and passive, and he rarely showed his anger. Glover's wife was described as an authoritarian, and his mother-in-law was constantly nagging him. He was quite forthcoming with his distaste for old women, and he resented the fact that many of them lived in his neighborhood. Wonder who the granny killer is now. So police put out a 24-hour surveillance on Glover, and they even put an electronic tracking device on his car. On Monday, March 19th, Glover left his house at around 9 a.m., called into work, goes to a liquor store, buys a bottle of scotch, and goes to a house in Beauty Point. Police check on to see who lives there in Beauty Point, and it is 60-year-old Joan Sinclair. Oh. The officers sit outside, and they're waiting for him to come out. He just never does. And in fact, they wait, and they wait, and they wait. And in fact, they wait most of the day. And at 9 p.m., a dog that's inside the house starts to bark nonstop. So the officers decide they need to go figure out what's going on. They hop the fence, they go in the back of the house, and they look in. And there on the floor lay Jane Sinclair. Her skirt was up over her hips, and a bloody hammer was nearby. When they go inside, they find pantyhose wrapped tightly around her neck.
Why would they just sit out there when they know that there's an older lady living in there and that I just don't understand that?
What grounds? Can they go in?
Go knock on the door.
I mean, they're following him.
Go knock on the door.
Yeah, but they're just surveilling. They can't do anything until the crime's committed. They don't know that for sure. They have to get evidence. They don't have any evidence. He's a suspect. He's a sexual assault suspect.
He's a killer.
They have to catch him. Well, he is, but they have to find out that he killed somebody first. They have to put him, they just can't follow him around.
Can't they just go knock on the door and pretend like they're going door to door for a police cotillion tickets?
I have no idea.
Well,
I know they were very regretful of the incident. There's tons of apologies that happen.
Apologize all you want. She's already gone now.
So police go and search the house, and in the bathroom, in the bathtub filled with cold water, was an unresponsive John Glover. Once again, he had tried to commit suicide. He had taken a bunch of pills and washed it down with the whiskey that he bought previously. But lucky for him and the police, he threw up most of what he took down, and he was survived. They take him to the hospital. Police then go to Glover's house, and they find the shoes that match the prints that were left in Mrs. Falconer's carpet. Once Glover was able to talk to police, he admitted that he and Joan had had an affair. They had known each other. And he said that they believed that he was working on an insanity plea, that half of him wanted to do these things, but, quote, good John didn't. So he was trying to get the split personality thing. So at trial, Glover pleads not guilty, but he does talk about his mother. She was divorced to his father when Glover was 14. And as soon as he was old enough, his mom made him quit school. He said she wanted him to work to support her because she didn't want to work. She had been remarried 4 times, and he described his mother as, quote, fast and having low morals. And he also spoke of how much he hated his mother-in-law. 3 psychiatrists would take the stand and say that Glover was sane and knew right from wrong. One stated that Glover derived sexual gratification from the cruel and sexual nature of his crimes. On November 29th, 1990, Glover was found guilty of 6 counts of murder and was sentenced to life in prison. He was also sentenced for the attack of 2 other women. Nice in prison, but in May of 2005, Glover told some prison officers, quote, I've had enough and I want to kill myself. So they put him on suicide watch. And on the 10th of September, 2005, he finally completed suicide. 72-year-old Glover was found dead in his cell. He had hanged himself. That's our Johnny Killer.
I have questions.
Let me see if I can answer them.
So he hated his mother and all elderly
his mother-in-law
folks, right?
Yep.
So he rapes them and kills them, assaults them, right?
Right.
They never really said rape, but can
it's
we...
we can say that it probably most likely
if you're
was
taking off the panties,
there was some rape. Yeah. One of the things that I read said that he had seen a photograph of his mother when she was younger, who was laying on her stomach with the skirt pulled up to her waist that showed her
hoo-ha.
Naked, her naked bottom and girly bits. Her legs were pretty much how the women were.
He
left Mrs. Falconer. That's how the mother was positioned in the photograph. It was kind of an erotic photo. Mm-hmm. Maybe not for him. It probably pissed him off. But yeah, it was. Yeah.
What an asshole. Sorry, yeah. But he is. The elderly and kids, like, they're defenseless.
And animals, yes.
And animals. Mm-hmm. Those are the worst.
I know. And like these women, if the photos of these women, they were your kindly.
Their grandmas.
Small, petite, little grandmas with the roller set hair and.
Their grandmas.
Their grandmas. It's.
Grandmothers. Horrible. He's a terrible person.
And it said that he took the money and he would go grab drinks.
To high five himself?
Bars. Yeah. Like he'd take the money and he'd spend it at bars.
Did it ever say if he purposely dropped that wallet in the park of which the lady's
no,
husband?
Nothing that I came across
was.
Said.
I bet you it was. Unless that's just that. A neighborhood park, but I bet you it was. He did that on purpose.
Yeah. I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, I've never heard of that, Jen. I've never heard of that. That there are some people out there that are. And then he says the good John and the bad John. Come on.
Trying to get that defense going.
They're defenseless. Murder is always wrong. Always. Mm-hmm. But like
but
little old ladies
pick
that
on
stop
the weakers.
Because they think that somebody's going to ask them a question. Of course they want to help. They're grandmothers.
Oh, yeah. They're grandmothers. They're sweet. And
you want some cookies? You want some food? You want some food?
I
How
mean,
about
not
some food?
All
you
grandmothers are sweet. God knows. Let's put it that way. But yeah, these women, poor things.
That was very good on day
six. And on that note, with the granny killers, you better go get your cookies made like a.
And make sure you get your grandparents a nice holiday gift.
Exactly. Or at least call them. Call your grandparents and let them know how much you love them and appreciate them. That would be nice.
I'm just thinking.
If you're lucky enough to still have your grandparents
there
around.
There you go.
That's what I should say.
Yes. That was a good story,
unfortunately, I don't. Yeah. But anyway, he was a real sumbitch.
He was.
As most of these are that I've been doing. So each one gets worse and worse and worse.
They really do. There's just, you know, and I know we've talked about this in the past, and I'm sure with that advent of that World Wide Web thing and the media saturation, like we know so much more about this. I'm sure these people existed long ago. We just never heard about them.
Oh, yeah.
But it just, and maybe it's because we do a podcast. Maybe it's just a little pot. But now I cannot look at anybody without thinking things, bad things. Like,
oh.
What? Don't stand too close to me. Get away from me. I have your license plate number. I see what kind of car. You know, I think these things.
Exactly. Well,
that's a terrible place to be.
I start mentally if I'm like alone walking somewhere and I pass people that I get the heebie-jeebies from, I mentally make a note to try to remember what they look like.
Oh, yeah.
Just in case or.
Always. Always.
I've become more protected of my kids ever since doing this podcast. Like. Mm-hmm. Especially with this 12 Nightmares Before Christmas that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously, I've been scared, I should say, paranoid. So.
Remember the day that my daughter's car broke down at the park and it was 8 o'clock at night and I hysterically lost it because there's just, and my son was like, Mom, she's fine. I had to go get her and I'm crying hysterically. She's alone in a park, right? Mm-hmm. And I get there and there's three adult men staying with her till I got there.
Oh, yeah.
Which, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that and being a nice person and doing a kind thing. But, of course, having a podcast, it's just not.
It's three adult men are with my daughter alone in the park at night. Yep. Oh, I get it.
Yep.
I hear you.
So, anyway.
Makes you wary.
It does. Well, tomorrow we are back to day 7. And until then. I hope you're making cookies and cleaning and wrapping and having a good time with people that you love and care about.
Or at least
or
like
stomaching,
and tolerate.
Or stomaching the ones you don't like.
Exactly.
We all have a few of those, don't we now? Till then, Jen, remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Jen. For more information about this episode, as well as all other sources, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by the hosts, Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. You can reach Nico at wetalkofdreams.com. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from Octoberpod VHS. You can find all of his great works on YouTube. Please make sure to like and subscribe to our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter with the handle at Our True Crime Pod. You can also email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. We would also at this time like to thank our patrons. We would be so lost without you. Thank you so much. And if you would like to help support the show, you can check us out on patreon.com/ourtruecrimepodcast. You can also show your support by leaving a 5-star review on Apple or simply just tell your friends about us. It's that easy. Love ya. He was impotent and not important. He was impotent. And he was a passive man and he impotent. Rarely impotent. Mm-hmm. He
you
was
said impotent.
He is impotent. If you are impotent, you can't say impotent or impotent. Mm-hmm. It's the right thing. He's impotent.
Are you joking right now?
No. Look it up.
It's impotent, isn't it?
It is impotent, but you can say impotent.
You can?
I think so. Hold on.
I've never heard of that. I'm impotent to everybody.
I'm impotent.
Maybe I'm wrong. I mean,
it is impotent, but I swear to God it was impotent. Or maybe that's a joke. That's if I'm going to be impotent.
That's what I'm saying.
I don't know.
I was like, are you serious? I thought you were doing a play on the mm-hmm. word. Oh,
no.
Boy.
I swear to God you could say impotent.
I don't think you can. Because I think, no, I don't think you can because there'd be too many jokes about that. Impotent. I'm impotent to everybody. Oh, boy. Oh, my God. That just made me die. Okay. I'm sorry. Oh, okay.
Impotent.
Impotent. You can cut that out, Nico.
Don't cut it out. Put it at the end. Oh, my God. That's hilarious. I thought you were joking. I'm crying laughter here because you're like, yeah, he's impotent.
See?
He's impotent.
Look.
Okay. Hold on. Let me catch my breath.
I just emphasized the wrong syllable. That's all. Sorry. Hey, I've been in the hospital. Leave me alone. Okay. Are you ready? Deep breaths.
I know. I'm sorry.
I'll start that over. And it's not until 6 p.m. that a dog inside of the house starts to bark. Starts to bark. Blah, 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 blah.